Welcome to the Upper Hand Podcast, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all things hand surgery related, from technical to personal.
Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And thank you in advance for leaving a review and leaving a rating wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hey, Chris.
Hey, Chuck. How are you?
I'm better now that you're here.
Oh, my God. It's been such an ordeal getting here. So I originally had a flight that was... So first off, where are we?
Yeah, where's here?
We should probably say that.
Where's here? We are in London at the XL Convention Center, and I've had a delightful few days. I've been here for a while. You were,
I've been here about an hour. So I was supposed to be here about 8 hours ago, but my flight from D.C. to London was delayed 6 hours. I found that out when I woke up before doing cases on Tuesday. So then I was wondering what I was going to do with my 8-hour layover in D.C. So then my flight from St. Louis to D.C. also got delayed. So I completely changed itineraries, went from St. Louis to Chicago. And when I got to Chicago, I found out my flight from Chicago to London was delayed 2 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours, 8 hours.
So what do they call television here? TV?
I thought it was the telly.
I was watching the telly, and apparently there's travel problems galore all over England, and the people getting back from holiday and the like. So it's not just us Americans who are getting affected.
Yeah, no, it was not a fun experience. And, it definitely makes me appreciate how relatively easy it was to move around before the pandemic.
For sure. So maybe we should, for listeners who don't know what the IFSSH is and why we are here, maybe we should give some background. And some of the audience may be willing to help us here. So the IFSSH is the International Federation for Society of Surgeons of the Hand, and it's a partnered meeting with the International Hand Therapist Group as well. I think it's just the two major groups. And... and FESH, yes, the Federation of European Societies for Surgeons of the Hand.
When the ASSH was founded, why couldn't they just be the Hand Surgery Society?
I don't know.
It's got to be the surgery of the hand. It always adds another level of complexity to all of the acronyms we have.
It's hard to speak that into a microphone, I think, is also a truism. Anyways, there are 3,600 people here, which I think is a really impressive number, given that we're still sort of in a pandemic, although I may be the only person walking around with a mask. If you guys have seen me, I am wearing a mask most of the time, but not many other people are.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised, at least in Chicago and on the flight from Chicago to London. There were actually a fair number of people in masks. And I have found that the mask is very useful because when I pass out on a plane, nobody can see me do this anymore.
It is true, for sure.
Very, very helpful.
For sure. So I have been attending congenital hand talks, obviously. I've also been attending wrist arthroscopy talks. I think they're fundamentally, the congenital hand, I think, is universal, and people have generally the same approaches, may have different techniques, but the wrist arthroscopy is interesting. I think the European hand surgeons approach it a little differently than American hand surgeons. There's a lot of talk about foveal TFCC tears, as we have talked about, and there's a lot more emphasis on DRJ arthroscopy and scoping in the subsurface area of the TFCC, which I think is important. And now with some new technology, not to mention specific companies, but Arthrex has a really improved nanoscope. I think it's going to make it easier to do that and be more precise with our foveal repairs. And there really were some good talks on that topic.
Great. Sounds like you're learning quite a bit here.
I think I am.
Okay. Well, Chuck and I are going to probably talk about a case or something, but if you guys in the audience have any burning questions you want to ask us, please do not hesitate. Come up, ask us. Happy to answer anything that comes up. So, Chuck, I had an interesting case recently.
I'm guessing it's a nerve case.
It's actually not a nerve case.
Not a nerve case. Okay. Well, that's reason to celebrate.
When we had George Orbe on the podcast, one of the things that I took from that discussion was how he says that he designed that volar plate to fit a well-reduced fracture. And there are so many of us now that will use the plate as a reduction tool, like we will for many fixed angle plates, locking plates, etc. So when do you think you can get away with that maneuver And when can you not? That distal first fixation strategy where you're trying to just get a little bit better tilt. And how hard do you work to get a reduction before that?
So I'm gonna show my age here, which is clearly visible to all in the room. But I started using Orbe's plate, the Hand Innovations plate, in 2002, right when I started practice. And to show you how new things were, he was traveling around the country, and I was a brand new surgeon. I just finished my fellowship, and in my fellowship, I'd done a little volar plating, but not with the Hand Innovations plate. And he came to town and spent a couple hours with me just talking about his plate and about the process, et cetera. And when I first started, and I'd be interested in perhaps opinions of those in the room. When I first started, I was convinced that you could always use the plate as a reduction tool. And the longer I've been doing this, the less convinced I am and the less often I try to use it as a reduction tool, to the extent that now I really almost only use it if I'm performing an osteotomy, and then I'll use the plate to help recreate the normal anatomy. But for an acute fracture, I don't. Do you?
Sometimes. I've done it less and asked less of the plate since our conversation with Orbe, because I thought about it more and it made so much more sense. But I think you can get 10 degrees out of the plate. In the standard patient where you're, you know, at least in the U.S., an osteoporotic patient with not great bone, if you ask too much of that, of those screws in there, you're going to end up in a very catastrophic kind of situation where you don't have many options after that. The reason I ask is that the case I did recently was a patient who had a coronal shift but also had a dorsally displaced fracture. So the classic pattern with the addition of the coronal shift. So we've got, you know, the it's probably about 30 degrees tilted dorsally, and then you've got translation of the shaft of the radius in the coronal plane. So the work that that's been done in Australia and in New York has shown us that's probably a recipe for some DRJ instability. So we worked hard to correct that.
Can I interrupt?
Yeah.
So specifically, just so we're all on the same page, I think you're describing a scenario where the distal fragment appears translated radially.
Yes.
And the shaft is converging with the ulna.
Yes.
And that was initially really not talked about much.
Right.
And I think it's recently, whatever that means, last 5-7 years, that we really paid more attention to that, especially when it's obvious, but even in the less obvious situations, we paid more attention.
Now, I'm going to date myself because I worked on that when I was a resident.
So 5 years ago?
Exactly. But so I was trying hard to correct both planes, and it was just really hard to get both in the same way. And when I fix a distal radius fracture, one of the things I like to do is get as good of a reduction as I can, hold it provisionally with the percutaneous K-wire, just so I can plate around that and there's less things that are moving. I don't know that you don't typically do that. You tend to hold the reduction and let people plate around your fingers.
I do. All right, let's go back for a second. Maybe we'll start with the show of hands. I would like this to be participatory.
Yeah, I think it'd be great.
So, who uses a volar plate as a reduction tool on a regular basis? Let's just start by show of hands. So so we have one person who uses the plate as a reduction tool. Do others just avoid that technique?
Well, how many are surgeons in the audience?
I'm about to talk.
Of course.
Yeah. We don't know, but please, yeah, talk in there.
I just came in. What are you talking about? Distal radius or
PS? Distal radius case, yes.
Yeah, we're talking about a distal radius case. We're talking about how often you would use the plate as a reduction aid. So a lot of surgeons in the audience, and only one that uses it as a reduction aid?
Interesting.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Just because the plate that we commonly use, the person who actually designed it uses it that way. So that's how he's looking at it.
You were non-commercial, but which plate do you use?
Acuvar.
Okay.
All right, okay. So we had a contribution from, what's your name?
Harry
from the audience told us that.
Harry from where?
Oh, Harry from Liverpool.
Okay.
Harry Excellent. From Liverpool told us that he uses the volar plate in that manner because the person that designed the Acumed plate uses it in that manner.
Harry, have you recovered from the two losses to end your season?
I'm actually an Arsenal fan.
Oh, my God. Do you know who owns Arsenal?
American?
Yeah, an American named Stan Kroenke, and I probably shouldn't badmouth him, but we don't like him in St. Louis because he took our football team and moved them to L.A.
American football team.
American football team. Yes, American. All right, sorry.
I don't even know where I was anymore. So I was trying to figure out how much reduction, how perfect I needed to make the volar tilt before trying to use the plate as a reduction aid. And I don't know when you say, all right, what will you accept now? Because I think we all would, you know, say that neutral is probably acceptable. My issue, I think it's acceptable from a fracture perspective. I don't think it's acceptable from a flexor tendon perspective. Because with the plate, with the fracture in neutral, that plate's going to sit more prominent, it's going to sit more distal, and it's going to irritate your flexor tendons more.
Well, and I think you just got to the crux of the matter. If you accept neutral, which I do, and you use a thicker plate, and to me, I use the Acumed plates as well.
The old thick boy?
They are thick,
yep.
As opposed to some of the alternatives, which are much thinner. You can, you know, if you don't restore volar flexion, 5 degrees, 7 degrees, 9 degrees, you're right. You can end up in a situation where your nerve is not happy. See, I knew you would talk about nerve.
Well, I was talking about the tendons, but I mean, they're close enough. They've longitudinally running structures. So I got the patient to neutral, but I just wasn't happy enough.
Why did you stop at neutral? Because you were having difficulty both restoring the coronal and the sagittal alignment?
It was trying to do both at the same time. So then I got a laminar spreader in, corrected the coronal shift, got a little more tilt by holding it reduced, and you know that maneuver where you kind of take your thumb, put it on the metaphysis for the fracture, take your index finger, wrap it around the outside, and tilt it over to help hold that, and then had the had our trainee pin it in that position, and I liked it. But then it just kept sliding back a little bit. So then I went to the distal first strategy because I thought that would give me an extra 5 to 10 degrees, and it worked great. But it always makes me nervous asking because, you know, when you do that, you've got the distal first strategy where the plate is sitting perfectly where you want it on the distal fragment, but it's hanging up and it's sitting up in the sky. And you hope that when you bring that plate down with an instrument, your thumb, whatever it is, that the screws don't pull out of the distal fragment when you're doing that maneuver.
I have not had that happen, even an osteopenic bone. Does everyone know the laminar spreader trick? Does anyone? Okay, good. At least there's one no. So the laminar spreader trick is not my trick. Terry, do you know? Dr. Light is in the audience. Have you used the laminar spreader? So the laminar spreader trick is the easiest thing ever, but it's fantastic. You take ideally not the laminar spreaders that have the hooks on the end, the kind of flat laminar spreaders, and you put it between the shaft of the radius and the ulna, and then you simply open the laminar spreader. So it slides the shaft over. It is a fantastic trick. But as Chris said, the challenge technically is both accomplishing your coronal and your sagittal alignment. But sounds like you got it done.
Yeah, it took me longer. It was more iterative than I wanted it to be. I knew I had a flight to catch, that kind of thing. But my flight being delayed made me just kind of relax, yeah. So it was okay.
I have a crazier case, but anyone have a comment about this kind of case? I have an unusual case to share as well.
Any tips and tricks on distal radius fracture fixation from the many surgeons we have in the audience?
A favorite pearl that you want to share with the world, or at least our 6 listeners?
Do you think that when we first started using these plates, we tended to put the screws all the way through the bone and had the leverage to kick it up by going distal first? Now that we're putting the screws 3/4 of the way through, we're not trying to get through the dorsal cortex, that maybe that's why we feel we're more prone to cutout and want to get the reduction first.
I can go first. I will say when I first started using the Hand Innovations plate, it was impressed on me the importance of putting each of those screws subchondral. And there were both pins and screws included, and I would use a combination, not because there was any science behind that, but I used a combination, and I absolutely drilled bicortically and felt really good. And you're right. We know, and some of the work's been done in St. Louis, we know that if you get past, I don't know, 65-70% of the way to your dorsal cortex, then you will have a secure fixation. But I still, in really osteopenic or parotid bone, I really do like my screws right up under the surface. But I will occasionally drill bicortical, even though a lot of us think that's sacrilege. I think it's a very, very important point.
I go bicortical when I'm using the screws in this manner. And then I swap them out later on. But I think, you know, I just worry about that. And that's a mistake. I'm willing to spend in the U.S. about $60 on a cortical screw to waste.
Yep.
Jeff Steppen, you're here. Traveling IFSSH, traveling fellow, the only American to be pulled for
that
honor.
Come over and talk to us about your traveling fellowship.
Jeff, is there anything you wanted to share? You brought friends here with you?
Did bring friends.
Okay, that's good. That's good. Okay. All right. Just for the record, Jeff is declining the opportunity to speak to this tremendous audience of 2,000 listeners a week. Jeff has nothing to say. Okay. All right, Chuck, what's your interesting case?
All right. So this is a little more complex, but hopefully it'll be interesting to everyone. So the patient is aware that I might mention her on the podcast, and I think she had had 8 wrist surgeries. As my math recalls, and I might be being too generous, the first 3 or 4 were not by me. She had DREJ instability after a distal radius fracture.
In addition to the procedures she had elsewhere, we performed separately a radius osteotomy to correct angulation and deformity, an ulnar shortening osteotomy, a wrist arthroscopy, a foveal TFCC repair, and an Adams-Berger repair as well.
One of my character flaws, and my wife would tell you I have many, is that I always look for a simplistic approach. And I think as a surgeon, I like that, but sometimes that's not the right way to go. And so I was accepting a previously fixed distal radius fracture, which was imperfectly aligned, and I thought there was a chance we could get away with simply shortening the ulna, using the ulnar carpal ligaments, dragging them proximally, increasing stability, and it didn't work. It didn't work well enough.
So shortening the ulna, not a DERA.
Shortening the ulna.
Got it. Okay.
And then I do think one of the next procedures was a radius osteotomy. I scope a lot of wrists. I did a wrist scope and was initially underwhelmed, and then in one of the subsequent procedures clearly identified a foveal tear. I used an ulnar tunnel technique, repaired the foveal tear. In the operating room, felt really good about the stability. But again, it failed to provide a stable wrist for the long term.
So was the patient's complaint pain or instability?
Yes. Painful instability.
It's tough.
And so here we are. We are in a young patient, 30-ish year old patient, who basically said, I need to be done with this. I need one more surgery. I don't want any chance of having an additional surgery. And I should mention, and I've said this on the podcast before, and I don't know everyone's philosophy in the room, if I have a challenging situation, I encourage people to seek a second opinion. I'm never afraid of others questioning my work, especially in a situation like this. She did not. At least she didn't tell me she did, but I don't think she did, which I would have preferred that she had. And so we're back to me in a very frustrated, young, active patient who wants one more surgery. Let me repaint the scene. The distal radius looks good. It's healed in a good position.
Because you fixed it.
Because we fixed it. There's a plate on the distal radius. I had taken the ulna shortening plate back off. So we have a distal radius volar plate. We have an ulna, which is neutrally aligned, maybe slightly ulnar negative. And we have not subtle DREJ instability.
And where are we at tilt-wise?
Neutral. Not volar, but neutral.
Got it. Okay. And the original fracture, was there any involvement of the sigmoid notch in terms of, you know, volar ulnar fragment or dorsal ulnar fragment, anything like that?
No.
Styloid fracture of the ulna?
I believe there was a styloid fracture, but it was a sort of a distal fracture, which I don't think contributed to any instability.
And you've already scoped the wrist and repaired the TFCC?
Yes.
What the hell are you going to do?
Yeah, I'd be interested if anyone wants. So I can give you my differential operative options. A DREJ prosthesis, a DERA or an aggressive DERA, a tendon graft reconstruction, Adams-Berger operation, so to speak, which to me has sort of faded a little bit. And then the other one is a one bone forearm.
What about doing nothing?
I think in some patients that would be the best option. I didn't think that was a fair option for this patient. Am I missing any options?
And so I know that you said she has pain and instability. What do you think is really driving her nuts? Is it because you did miss an option of denervation, which I don't love personally, but that is an option. And if it's mainly pain, denervation really burns no bridges from a future surgery perspective, although some would argue it's not great for the joint. What about that? And if not, if it mainly is instability, do you think you're going to get stability of the DREJ with a prosthesis?
First question regarding denervation. Are there any denervation lovers in the room? We got a microphone for you. Tell us about it. Do you do it regularly? I'm sorry. Please share your name and institution. And
I'm Femke. I'm actually Jeff's friend, co-travel fellow from the Netherlands. One friend.
Jeff's only friend.
I'm Jeff's one friend. Yes, we do use denervation a lot in CMC thumb. So that is our first, before trapeziectomy, our first line of treatment these days.
And you've been happy with it?
Yes, very much. Yeah. We don't have very long-term results yet. So that's also what I tell my patients, is that we don't know for how long it works, but the initial results are almost comparable to trapeziectomy. So that's very encouraging.
There's denervation and then there's denervation. So are you cutting two nerves? Are you cutting the 18 nerves that go in there? Well, how do you do it?
I think we do a pretty extensive approach where we have a three incision approach, one in the dorsal aspect of the forearm to take out the PIN and AIN, then the dorsal part of the thumb for that small RSN branch that goes straight into the joint, and then we do a Wagner approach where we lift the thenar muscle and denervate the whole volar aspect, and It's a procedure that takes about an hour. So we also do strip the FCR and strip the radio artery. So yeah, I guess that's pretty extensive.
Yeah, I don't. Thank you for sharing. Denervation is never top of mind for me. I think that's a fair comment that it could have been an option here. And I haven't really done enough to know whether it would have worked in this situation, but perhaps it could have.
I feel like I'm walking the dog here.
Anyone? Yes, please.
Have you done diagnostic injections? Can you localize that the pain is coming from the articular surface, sigmoid notch, distal ulna?
Yes. And I guess technically I did a steroid injection with lidocaine, and it did improve her symptoms temporarily. Anyone put a prosthesis in this patient? In a 30-ish year old patient. Yeah.
So I'm Rob. I'm from East Grinstead, which is a bit south of London. I had a very similar patient referred to me who I think was even younger. She'd had distal radial fracture. She'd had a corrective osteotomy. She'd had an ulna shortening. And she came to with an unstable DRUJ. And not much pain, but instability, or pain related to instability. And she had an Adams Burger, which worked well, and then she disappeared. And then she had another child and came back a few years later and was clunky again. Again, not that painful, but and I didn't know what to do, so I sent her to somebody else. And I believe that he was considering putting a Schecter-type prosthesis in, but then COVID happened. I don't know what happened after that. The only other point I was just going to say is I do some denervations, not a huge number, and in my experience is that it's quite good for pain, but pain that comes with instability, it's not so good for.
Chuck, how many times did you do an Adams Burger before you realized it was probably not ideal? Because it looks great in the textbooks.
Many of you don't know this patient population, or maybe you do, but it's different in America, I'm certain. The first patient I did it on was a workers' compensation patient, which there's always an asterisk next to those patients in our literature because they're you know, secondary motivations. And the patient, for some, the patient failed my Adamsberger reconstruction, but didn't want additional surgery, came back to see me for another problem, another work injury, and had no complaints with his wrist. So I was confused by that. I probably have done it a handful of times, and I don't think it's it wasn't a positive enough experience to continue to do it. And I think many of the surgeries done were reflective of our lack of understanding of the TFCC and the foveal insertion of the TFCC. And I think we were, we being the community, I think was trying to use that in a, for a situation where a foveal repair probably would have been sufficient. So I don't want to belabor it more, but I, and Dr. Light probably knows what I did, but, I did a one bone forum because I think it's a fantastic operation when you get to the point that nothing else works. And in kids, it's something that we do with when there's gross longitudinal instability congenitally. And it's a really, really good operation as long as the patient understands what they're going to lose, which is obviously forearm rotation. But I've been really happy with it. I've done it a handful of adults, more kids, and it's a great operation.
So for those that are uninitiated, what does the X-ray from a one bone forearm look like? And why didn't you just do a DARA?
I thank you. I didn't do a DARA because I think that would have led to just the instability moving proximally. So I didn't think that made sense for me. So there's two forearm operations. One is a radial ulnar synostosis. So you leave the radius and the ulna in place and you fuse them to one another. The other is you remove the proximal portion of the radius and the distal portion of the ulna and you put them end to end with the plate, which is what I favor. It's a little bit of a bigger operation. Removing the proximal radius and the distal. Distal ulna part is usually not so difficult, especially in a situation like this where there's instability. But the removing the proximal radius is something. Make a separate incision. I actually find that little nerve that you probably love called the radial nerve and keep it safe. And there you go.
What did the patient tell you afterwards?
So I've only had one post-operative visit, and she said she was more sore than she expected, and she pointed to where I pulled the... I mean, what you do is you cut the radius, and you sort of pull it out of one of the incisions. It's really something. Dr. Light wants to comment.
You know, you have a painful joint. I think you can stiffen it, you can fuse it, you can resect it, put in a prosthesis or fascia or some interposition. You can do a fusion of the distal radius and ulna and resect bone proximally, salve capange, which in many cases just shifts the problem more proximally. But why not just fuse the two bones together and put a block of iliac crest between the two of them? I just take a recon plate and leave the rest of the anatomy undisturbed.
Yeah, I
worry that you're doing this resection of the proximal radius and you're going to destabilize the elbow or create other problems.
I haven't seen that. What I have seen is sometimes there's a delayed healing, and you really have to decorticate the radius and the ulna. But I certainly wouldn't argue. I mean, I think it's dealer's choice, and I agree. You know, taking out the proximal radius is not a small addition to the surgery.
Is there still a role for the salve capange in 2022?
I guess I would say people used to talk about it for Madelung's deformity to increase the surface of the articulating, you know, radiocarpal joint. I don't think there's a role for it there.
My practice, I've had two kinds of results: excellent and poor.
There's
some patients in which it works and others in which it doesn't. If there's a fundamental instability, it just shifts the instability proximally. And so I think it's, at least for me, it was unpredictable.
Yeah, I don't use it anymore, the salve capange.
Well, so now I know that if I have a patient with ulnar side of wrist pain and instability after disarrhythmias fracture, I can say, well, there's a guy down the street who's just going to cut out a bone. And give you one bone in your forearm, we could do a DARA.
It's a threat.
You'll be fine.
It's a major threat. And clearly a patient like this not only had TFCC pathology, but had interosseous membrane pathology. Because it doesn't make any sense otherwise.
Do you believe in reconstruction of the interosseous membrane?
I do not.
Does anyone do that? I mean, not to judge. Sorry, that was very poorly.
No, I've tried it. I just hadn't succeeded. Has anyone seen a successful interosseous membrane reconstruction for longitudinal instability? No. We have shaking of heads.
There is lots of shaking heads.
Yeah. Anyone want to share a case or ask a question or...
And it can be on the air or off the air. Okay. Good to know. So, Chuck, what are you looking forward to at the meeting the most?
So, we've said I've had a few meetings since, this year. And I've actually been traveling a lot. And I'm looking forward to not traveling so much. But I think the real joy of this meeting is just seeing people I haven't seen in a long time. Our congenital group got together on Sunday and Monday, and I missed it. My son was graduating college, which was fantastic, but I missed it. I think it's seeing people. I think there's a remarkable amount of congenital content here, thanks to WE. And that has been very good so far. And then I also, as I mentioned earlier, I do enjoy the European perspective on the wrist and wrist arthroscopy, and that's been good.
Any more talks to give?
I have a few tomorrow. Yeah. So, talking about finger fractures in an 8 a.m. session, talking with you on social media, and then talking about arthrogryposis outcomes and assessments in the afternoon. All super exciting. I'm sorry? Oh, yes, yes, yes. There is a congenital quiz show scenario. I think it's continents against one another. So maybe there's an Americas, a European group, and an Asia/Australia group. I think that's all. And I wonder who's going to come in second.
So, so are you participating in this, or is this like trainees sponsored by, like, coached by you guys?
I'm a participant.
Oh, boy.
I might embarrass myself.
There are going to be many of your former trainees who want to see this.
Get a good laugh. Yeah. So what are you looking forward to at this meeting?
So I'm just glad I made it here. I've got a talk to you tomorrow morning on physical examination of the plexus, a skills session in the afternoon on the same topic, and then our session on social media. I'm spending a day with my friend Tom Quick on Friday at the Royal National Orthopedic Hospital in their plexus unit as part of my travels for the Gelberman Scholarship from a couple of years ago. We're finally back on track. So I'm looking forward to that. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
So what do you have planned for the day with Mr. Quick?
Oh, I think it's going to be a half day of the, as you call it here, the theater, and a half day of the clinic. So I think it'll be really fun, and research meetings and just kind of learning about how they approach things here. I think it's obviously a very different healthcare system, and there's a lot to learn from that.
Absolutely.
So I have one question to close, and it's a parenting question. So say...
Why, are you asking the audience? Yeah,
I just want to get a sense of whether I did the worst thing in the world or, you know. So it's the morning before I'm supposed to leave. I originally did not intend on doing cases before a flight because Rick Wright would always say there's nothing more stressful than having surgery than having to take a flight. So, but due to other circumstances, I had to. So I did, but I was leaving in the morning and my kids wake up probably around 6:30-ish. So I was like right around when I needed to leave. And I really wanted to say bye to them. So one of them took it very well, but the other one did not take it well. And I felt a little bad that I left my wife with a house full of two screaming kids, missing daddy and daddy splits.
So you did stay and say goodbye rather than sneaking out the back door.
Oh, no, I stayed. I stayed and I left a mess. Mm.
Yeah, you'll pay for that when you get back home.
Well, so the kicker is that I finished my cases and I was like, hey, my flight's late. I'm going to go home and have lunch and see the kids. She's like, what? You caused all of this commotion this morning. I had to listen to I Want Daddy for 20 minutes and fake crying, and now you're going to go home and see the kids? She's like, you deserve to be delayed.
Yeah, I don't dispense a lot of parenting advice because I am the lesser of our parent, of the two parents in my household. But I probably would have just snuck out the back door.
Well, unless there are any burning questions or commentary or things you want to throw at us. send flowers. Well, she's getting a lot of chocolate. That's if you've ever seen our house and seen one of us try to keep flowers alive, it doesn't work. But there'll be a lot of chocolate.
So this has been fun, but we haven't really done this before. I mean, there might be some things we would approach differently, get you here on time and, you know, things like that. But
I like how you planted Dr. Light in the audience. That was awesome.
Yeah. I drug him here kicking and screaming. No, this is fun. I think we could do this again. And we did bring some swag, which we will share. And thank you all. And we appreciate your listening and being here. And we have another podcaster in the audience. So all good. Thank you all and have a great rest of your meeting.
All right.
All right.
That's it.
Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter at Hand Podcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is at Congenital Hand. What about you?
Mine is at ChrisDMD, spelled D-Y. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand and come back next time.